Welcome, everyone. This is a special interview on the Noisecast with street photographer and teacher Mason Resnick. Mason, say hello to everyone.
Hello to everyone.
Awesome. And for those who don't know, Mason Resnick is, without a doubt, he is actually one of my favorite street photographers and has a long and illustrious career in the world of photography. Everything the photojournalism days, back when people had to use 35 mil cameras and digital was something that they talked about in wristwatches. So, you know, just give everyone a little, like, the brief version of, like, your background, Mason.
Okay, well, let's see, where can I start? I'll start in 1976. When I was 19 years old, I was told by one of my photography teachers at Queens College that he was starting a program at the Germain School of Photography, a place that no longer exists. But it was like a trade school for photographers, very basic stuff, you know, lighting classes and animal photography and that sort of thing. But he was doing an unusual summer program, and he had a bunch of master photographers who he wanted to get out there. I didn't really know Gary Winogrand at the time, but Herb Gurrow, who was my teacher, he thought it would be a really good idea for me to take his class. So I did, and for those of you who don't know who Gary Winogrand is, Gary Winogrand, I guess, could be considered one of the granddaddies of street photography. He was certainly one of the more influential and controversial photographers of the 20th century. But for me, he was a huge influence. And I took this class, and we'll get back to that later, but I took his class, and it really changed me totally, because up till then, I was on a track to become a commercial photographer, you know, and I was learning lighting techniques. I was learning how to run a studio, that sort of thing. And this turned me around 180 degrees because I always was interested in watching people, and not in a creepy way, but watching people and observing interactions and how people were protecting their personal space on the street and things like that. And then I saw Gary Winogrand's photographs in the class, and I thought, wow, you could take pictures of that? Because you could think what I was seeing, you know? And I thought, wow, I want to learn how to do that. That was a key moment for me. So at the tender age of 19, I got into that. And I really never looked back. Whatever else I've done in my career, street photography has always been the constant. The other things I've done in my career is I was the associate editor of Modern Photography magazine back in the day, back in the early to late 80s until it folded. Then I worked for a variety of trade publications and websites. I ended up, for 5 years, I was the managing editor of Popular Photography. That was in the from 2000 to 2005. And again, back in doing a lot of writing about photography for a number of different websites and retail sites. And, you know, I got to a point a few years ago where I said, you know, I'm now in my mid-50s back then, and maybe it's time to stop writing about other photographers and go ahead and be a photographer myself, go back to the original plan. And so that's what I've been doing now for the last few years on a part-time basis, and in the last few months it's become a full-time thing. So that's sort of in a nutshell, in 3 minutes, a summary of my career. Sounds kind of, I don't know, hope that sounded interesting.
No, absolutely. So we're going to jump into it, but you mentioned you took a class with Gary Winogrand, and I can't stress enough to listeners how the very notion of what we consider street photography today in large part was defined by Winogrand's work. You know, it's almost kind of part and parcel with the idea of what street photography looks like.
Right. And the irony is he hated the term. You know, he said, call it zoo photography.
Yeah. And it's funny how life is. Go ahead. Yeah, no, it's funny how that works out, because a lot of times I don't think people, especially like, I guess coming, well, maybe you could talk a little bit about it. So, you know we call this street photography because of the nature of where it's taken. But in truth, and just, you know, going through your book, your most recent book, your exposition on Tel Aviv, it's really people photography, right? Like,
I'd say that to a great extent it is, you know, really any, I mean, as Gary Winogrand said, anything is photographable in any way. So it could be people. I'm most interested in people. So it doesn't have to be called street photography. It's just photography, mm-hmm. which happens to have people in public places. And in general, they're not aware that I'm there taking their picture, or if they are aware, they don't care, or they don't know exactly what I'm doing with my camera, but they see me. Very few people actually yell. I could talk about getting busted. That does happen occasionally, but surprisingly not as often as you'd think.
Hold on.
My phone decided to speak up. I apologize for that.
That's all right.
Let me shut it up. Okay. Sorry, you can cut that part out.
Yep.
Or leave it. I don't care. Anyway, where were we?
So we were talking about getting busted.
Yeah. Actually, at one point in the, I was in the shuk in the open market in Tel Aviv, and I was working this one area, and one woman says, "You should not be taking pictures of people. It's very rude." And so I smiled, and we had a little conversation, and I walked away. And once I was out of her sight, I resumed taking pictures.
Right, absolutely.
You have to do that.
So, you know, so it's interesting. I guess when you first start as a photographer, I think a lot of people are instinctively drawn to the idea of taking photographs in public spaces. I think there's a misconception that it's easy to just kind of get out there, pick up the camera, and just like start snapping away.
Right.
You
end up with a lot of pictures of people's, the backs of people's heads at first.
Oh yeah, definitely. So, you know, how, one of the things that like, I absolutely love about your work, and one of the things that I loved about the book is especially was just kind of like a lot of the emotion that you capture in kind of the day to day. I think about an image of a woman in this market. I'm assuming it's the same market that you were talking about. And she has, I don't know, it's like she has like these bunny ears, and she's like, it looks like she's like looking right at you like, hey, and then there's like a guy like just slightly past her, and it looks like he's like looking to see what's going on. It's just like, it's kind of amazing.
I'm scrolling down to it right now as we're speaking.
Oh, okay.
But I happen to have the book open somewhere. I know it's coming up. It's not there. Where is it? There she is. Okay. Yeah. By the way, I could tell you the background. So one of the several days that I was in the market, in the Shuk, it's called Shuk HaKarmel, for those who are familiar with Tel Aviv. It's a very popular place, and it's just, you know, these incredible, you know, the vendors are, you know, cheek by jowl, everyone's crammed in together. There's a narrow space, maybe 6 feet wide, that everyone has to walk through, and it's like a squish point. I love using that term. A squish point is when people are forced into a very small area, mm-hmm. and that's when they're protecting their personal space and they're trying to avoid each other, and interesting things happen visually.
Right.
And I look at that. In this particular case, the woman with the bunny ears, this was photographed on Purim. Purim is a Jewish holiday, which it's one of the few where you are allowed to take pictures during the holiday. It's not a you can't work kind of day.
Okay.
So it's a great thing because people get dressed up in all sorts of crazy costumes. It's a celebration. And So I wanted to be in the Shuk for Purim because I figured something interesting would happen. And so several of the pictures in my ebook were taken on that day. Many were not, but it was especially crowded, which is great because that way I could work really super close and not really be noticed. You know, this is one of the challenges you're talking about, photographing people in public spaces. If they're wide open public spaces, it's more difficult to work in an intimate space, which is why I look for these, what I call squish points. Because when you are a couple of feet away from someone, they don't really think you're taking their picture. But you're going to get something more intense and more intimate.
Right, right.
So, that's why, that's one of the things that draws me to marketplaces like that. If you're in a big open square, if you're in Times Square, for instance, they kind of ruined Times Square in New York by turning it into a pedestrian mall.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one.
Yeah, for photographers, it's worse because it used to be everyone had to be on the sidewalk, and that created a natural squish point. You could still do that on 42nd Street, especially on a Wednesday afternoon, right before the shows start or right after they let out. That's when you get a flood of people, and it's good times. But what they've done to Times Square, unfortunately, not the best thing for interesting street photography. So, you go to other places in the city.
Yeah. You could always head downtown, like during lunch hour.
Absolutely. Yeah, downtown, actually going back to the Winter Grand class, that was the Germain School of Photography was at 80 Nassau Street.
Oh.
Which is really the heart of things. You have Fulton Street, you have Wall Street a few blocks away, and, people are out there. Broadway is a couple of blocks away, West Broadway, I think. And, there are throngs of people, and that's a great place for street photography.
Definitely, in New York. Definitely. So, Tel Aviv, you mentioned in the past that you've gone various times, and how long was the idea percolating, before you...
Oh, just very quick. So what happened was my wife works for AT&T, and she was moved into a team that's based out of kind of the outskirts of Tel Aviv, right near the airport, Ben Gurion Airport. And she was asked them, she was the only person in the United States on the team. A lot of telecommuting, they do that. They're a communications company, But she said, it would really be a good idea for team building and morale and everything if she went to Israel to meet with her team in person. And miraculously, they agreed. And said, why don't you go out for the first 2 weeks in March? This was in early February. So this had to come together really fast because we decided we wanted to get there the week before because that was Purim.
Right.
And we're so close, we might as well go for Purim. And it was great. So what happened is AT&T put my wife up in a nice hotel, and I got to stay there. And it was half price because we just had to pay for her airfare, rather for my airfare and my meals. And all of her expenses were paid for by AT&T. So it became a great opportunity. And while she was out doing her thing and working every day, I walked her to the bus right outside our hotel, saw her off, and then I was a free man in Tel Aviv for 2 weeks. And so I said, what a great opportunity to spend days and hours and hours just walking in the streets looking for pictures.
Right.
And that's pretty much what I did. So it was really an unusual opportunity. I've been in Israel before. I was there... this is my fifth visit. This is the first time I was there kind of on my own. Before that, I was going with college group or with a tour group. It was very structured. This was totally unstructured time. And that was special. That was unique for me. And I hope to do it again one day.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely an amazing project. I've never been to Israel, and just kind of seeing something different from, I guess, what people are accustomed to, especially here in the U.S. You know, you just get like these news clips and it always just kind of, it seems like it's purposely portrayed as foreign and something that you can't really quite connect to. But just seeing like people going about their day to day, it's just, it's so reminiscent. Like that could have been Brooklyn, you know, like.
Exactly. Except with a much nicer shoreline. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and I think that's one of the things that that really just kind of stands out about your book in specific. It's just it's in Israel. You know, obviously there are context clues everywhere, but at the same time, this could literally be any other place in the world, you know, you don't have to necessarily be of Israeli descent to necessarily be interested in a book like this. It's just that day in the life. And it's, again, like I said, it's like the faces. I know we're in an audio medium, but a lot of the faces and the expressions and emotions that you capture on the street are just, they're golden, man. You know,
thank you.
I got to say, one of my favorite ones is actually, and again, it's because there's just a lot going on. One of my favorite shots is on page 31. There's a trio of young women walking, talking, you know, doing what you see all over the world, right? You know, friends walking, you know, lunch or whatever. One is on the phone.
By the way, that was right outside our hotel.
You see, look at that. Didn't even have to work for that one, right?
Well, no. It's interesting because that was a great spot. It was our hotel was at a place called the Azrieli Center, which is really in the center of Tel Aviv. There's a train station right a block away. And right where I took that picture, it was a bus drop-off. There are literally hundreds of buses that go through that stretch, that both sides of that street, because it's a major transportation hub. So there's a lot of action there. That's like going through Times Square, going through like 34th Street, Penn Station area, or around Grand Central. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of hustle and bustle. And you're right. You know, Tel Aviv is really, it's a very cosmopolitan city. It has a French Quarter. It has a lot of French Jews have recently moved to Israel because of the anti-Semitism in France, and a lot of them have ended up in a certain neighborhood in Tel Aviv, and they go about their lives. There are some pictures in that neighborhood where you see some guys sitting at a French bistro.
You're right.
And you could be walking down a street in Paris and see a similar scene. And I think that just goes to, I think part of it's the universality of people, you know, that people are who they are. They're living their daily lives. I try to capture whatever looks interesting, but what often ends up being interesting is people living their lives. What I find interesting is your reaction, because you did mention before we started this that it wasn't what you were expecting.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I find that fascinating in its own right. I'm actually interested, I'm going to flip the script here, is what did you expect, or what were you expecting when I said, oh, a book of photographs of Tel Aviv?
So it's interesting because I only have two frames of reference with respect to Israel and specific Tel Aviv. One is a family friend who is an Iraqi Jew who kind of went back and forth, mm-hmm. Between living in Israel, living in Queens. And it's this guy who, he was almost kind of like an uncle. You know, he's like the family friend that's at every family function. And, he always has something, he always had something smart to say, right? So, and, he always kind of like, I hate going back home, because when I go back home, it's like you have the Orthodox Jews there, and it's just like they look down on me because I'm smoking and doing it. And it's just like, So it's kind of like, in my mind, it was almost like a very restrictive kind of like society in general. And then it's just like, oh, no, this is nothing like what this guy described. You know, like, this is like, this is New York. This is like, you know, one of the outer boroughs.
I think, you know, it's, you know, you could have a restrictive society in New York.
Absolutely.
As well. And I think, you know, it's, it depends on where you are. It depends on the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had gone to one of the more Haredi, which is to say more strict neighborhoods, I would have gotten different pictures.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the fact is, this is, you know, I tried to get to, you know, different areas of the city, but Tel Aviv tends to be a more secular city generally. Mm-hmm. There are a number of religious Jews there, but it's not as, you know, if you want to get a higher concentration of religious Jews, you know, Jerusalem is, you're going to see more of it there, you know, in some of the smaller towns, but, you know, Jerusalem has a different vibe, and that's actually my next project, is a book of photographs I took on the same trip in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And that's a totally different vibe.
Yeah, and I'm actually very interested, because we did mention, you know, we did speak about that very briefly when we were trying to set up this interview. You know, I'm really curious to see kind of like that dichotomy between the two, you know, kind of, because again, you know, Jerusalem, again, for frame of reference, for me, it's kind of like the holy city, you know, it's more, I imagine it to be a more somber, not somber, but a more serious.
Oh, you're going to be surprised.
Oh.
Well, I was also there for the second day of Purim. Israel has an anomaly. The rest of the world celebrates Purim on one day, but Jerusalem celebrates it the day after. So the day after I was in Tel Aviv photographing Purim, we went up to Jerusalem for their celebration of Purim, and it's many times crazier.
Interesting.
Up there.
That already sounds amazing.
I was also there for the Jerusalem Marathon, which is like the New York Marathon, but in Jerusalem. And, you know, 30,000 people running, and I was at the finish line and this huge park where there were thousands of people, and it was just, you know, shooting about 800 pictures that morning, you know, because it was just, there was something going on everywhere you looked, and there was really no break. I realized, like, you know, I stopped for lunch when it was over. I was like, oh man, I'm exhausted. I've been doing this for hours. And I was like, what, how many pictures did I take?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot even for me.
So that kind of, brings up kind of my next question. So you said 800 shots. Clearly you're not shooting film.
No, I haven't shot film in a long time. I consider digital to be a blessing to street photographers. Some people may take exception to that, mm-hmm. but it's a reality that, you know, the cost per image goes way down when you're shooting digital, you know, even factoring the cost of a computer and memory and the, you know, the cost of the camera. It's just, it made more sense for me to switch. I also found that I tend to shoot around ISO 1000.
Typically. Oh, interesting.
And because I'm shooting in a, you know, very quickly, I'm moving, the subjects are moving, you know, I shouldn't say the subjects, the picture is the mm-hmm. subject. The people in the picture are moving most of the time. And so I need fast shutter speeds and a good depth of field, that combination. And in order to get that, I need at least 1,000, sometimes 1,600, sometimes I even push it, you know, over 2,000. Because sometimes that's what I need. But I find the quality, even at 1,000, even at 2,000, is better than what I was getting with, you know, with Tri-X.
Right.
You know, when I shoot black and white. And I would say comparable to Fuji Press 800 when I'm shooting ISO 2500. It also depends on the camera you're using. You know, I'm using a full frame camera, and I think that also helps.
Definitely, definitely.
I think that the image quality is certainly better. It's the only downside with digital is it's too quick.
So, what do you mean by that? Like,
I can look at the picture right away, and I really shouldn't. Mm-hmm. It's better to let the pictures kind of simmer for a while. So I would try to make it an effort to not look at the pictures for at least a few weeks, preferably a few months. Gary Winogrand wouldn't look at his pictures for years, and in some cases he didn't even see them before he passed away, which is of course a whole separate discussion. Right. But, I want to look at the pictures a little colder. I don't want to be thinking about how I felt when I took a picture, because that can inform my decision about which images to use. You don't care how I felt when you're looking at a picture. You shouldn't care how I felt when you're looking at one of my pictures. You're seeing it cold.
Right. And it's interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up, because especially we live in this age of photography, we're living in, instant is, I feel, is even too slow of a word for what's going on, right? Like, people don't even let the memory set in. They've already shared it, to hundreds, if not thousands of people all over the world, right?
Right.
Do you feel that kind of takes away something from the art of photography, or is it just kind of like it is what it is?
It is what it is. I mean, it does water things down a little bit. For example, if you want to have a little fun, go on Instagram and type in the hashtag street photography and see what you get. And I will bet you that 10% will be street photos.
Yeah.
And of that, 10% will be good. I think street photography has become a buzzword. Mm-hmm. And, in that sense, I mean, I wrote an article not too long ago about maybe we shouldn't call it street photography anymore. Maybe we should call it something mm-hmm. else. It is street photography. I mean, we know as photographers, we tend to know what street photography is. Candid photos in public places. And, but it's all photography. And I think that what's happened is, I've seen boudoir pictures that are labeled street photography. I mean, come on.
Well, you know what it is. It's all about getting, trying to rack up those likes, rack up the likes and the exposure.
So the ebook is one way I'm trying to rise above that noise mm-hmm. and now working on some other things. But there is, that noise does exist. And so I think that's one of the downsides of the digital revolution. But I do think, people will go out in New York, take a bunch of pictures, edit them on the train coming back or whatever. I've seen this. And then that night they post pictures.
Right.
That's too soon, I think. let them sit. Let them sit on the computer for a while and then come back to them. I'm actually looking at pictures I shot a few about a year ago for the first time. And it's like, oh, okay, those look good. And then I remember thinking at the time, when I quickly looked through them, there are pictures I thought were really great at the time. And now I look at them and it's like, they're not so good. I'm not going to use those. But there are others that now stand out because I'm not caught up in the experience.
Right.
I think there's... the act of taking pictures, taking 800 pictures in a morning, that's insane, right? Or at least compulsive. but the editing process is taking a really long time and has taken a really long time because I don't rush that. It's a different kind of approach.
Yeah.
And so even though I'm looking through things in Lightroom and, can hit the forward button and go to the next one, the next one, the next one, I try to avoid doing that so quickly. And it's interesting. It's an interesting process. It's always been an interesting process. You know, when it was looking at contact sheets, developing everything in the darkroom, that was a separate type of process and a separate experience. The digital experience is just a little different. It just smells better.
And you don't need to jerry rig a fan to your bathroom window either. So that's always a plus.
You know, been there, done that, except it wasn't the bathroom, it was the boiler room.
See? I'm sure, you know, that's the thing. Anyone who's ever worked with film can attest to, you know, not missing the chemical scent that seems to permeate through your apartment.
Yeah, I mean, I part of me does miss it. I did like the smell of Fixer, I have to. And I do miss the magic of watching a print coming up in the Dactyl. But you know, we move on, and there are different experiences now. So
yeah, for sure. I'm not going to keep you on too long. I know we're doing this a little bit later in the evening, but
absolutely. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the Winogrand project.
So. Please. That's exactly where I was headed to. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. So back in April, I suddenly had a little extra time on my hands. And as I was transitioning from a half-time writer, half-time photographer to full-time photographer, and one of the things I decided to do was clean my office. And so I went through this massive cleanup that took a couple of weeks, which tells you how much of a slob I am. And lo and behold, I find a stack of envelopes. And what do I find in one of the envelopes are the negatives from the workshop that I took with Gary Winogrand in 1976. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you talk about revisiting images long after you've shot them. This is as old as you can get, you know? This is 42 years later, and I'm starting to look at them. So I actually created a new way of copying negatives that works really well for me. You know, using a light table and a macro lens and all that fun stuff, rather than using a film scanner, because the film scanner I found was just too slow, and I'd rather work in RAW anyway. So I've spent the last month or so, when I have the time, scanning in the pictures and finding absolute gold, finding some really cool pictures. And I have them on my blog. I've been kind of posting progress reports and, you know, here are the pictures that I've scanned in the last couple of days sort of thing. And I'm finding some pictures that are very interesting because now it's 42 years later. You know, I took them when I was 19. I'm now 61. The math, right? Yes. And math is not one of my...
There's a reason why we chose creative jobs, Mason.
Correct. I've been looking at these pictures, and because they're from 1976, they depict a New York that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that becomes interesting in its own right because, you know, the hairstyles, the clothing styles... are different, the cars that are driving by, the stores that existed back then. And this is all in Lower Manhattan, which is one of the reasons it's one of my favorite places to shoot in New York, because that's where I really cut my teeth as a street photographer. So I have that as one aspect of what I'm finding. The other thing that I'm finding is my teacher is in a lot of the pictures. I have a lot of photographs of Gary Winogrand working, taking pictures in New York.
Oh, that must be amazing.
And there may be some value in that. I'm not sure. I feel like that could be worth something to
somebody.
That's
a book by itself, if we're being honest.
Yeah, maybe a small book. Yeah. You know, I think it's a couple of dozen images right now. But and you see him, you know, he's walking the crowds. There was one shot that I'll talk you through. I haven't posted these pictures yet. I'm sort of saving the best for last. But there's one shot where there are two women who are looking at him. He is taking their picture, and they seem to be completely non. You can't even tell. They don't even know they're being photographed. And that's the way he was. You know, that was just watching him doing that was really helped me, become who I am as a photographer. So that's a big thing. So I'm working on that. There may be a portfolio, there may be a book or an ebook out of that. It's kind of a work and a thought in progress.
Well, it's definitely something that I personally would be interested in. Like, and this, I do realize that it comes from a New Yorker bias, because, you know, there's something about New York where you could have multiple people who are from New York who are actual New Yorkers, but New York would mean something very different to them. So,
right. And a lot depends on when they were living in New York, or when they were students in New York, or whatever, or if they're still living in New York, it's a different thing. You know, the city's changed so much in some ways and not at all in other ways. The other thing that impressed me about these pictures is no cell phones. There are phone booths, you know, and that's like, wow, you know, cell phones are kind of a gift to street photographers because people are more distracted than ever. But it does change the landscape.
I bet. It's funny you mentioned that, because just the other day I was in Queens and I saw a phone booth, and I stopped what I was doing and I like whipped out my cell phone and took a picture of the phone booth.
Irony there. Yeah. Cell
phones. So
gotta go meta and get a picture of someone shooting you shooting the phone.
That would have been great.
I'll look for that. No, I don't look for anything. I just, whatever comes up, that's what I shoot, you know, if it looks interesting.
Yeah, definitely. So one last thing before we wrap up. If you had to give any tips to someone just starting out in photography, whether as a career or as just a hobby, what would you recommend that they do?
Look for work that inspires you. Look for work that speaks to you. And it may be street photography. It may be something completely different, and that's all good. And it may be film, and that's good. And it may be digital, and that's also good. You know, it's what works for you. And sometimes it's a matter of just going, looking at good work, go to a museum and look at good work, pick up some photography books, look at them. You know, thank goodness we have the internet, and dang, we have the internet, because there's a lot of good work out there. There's a lot of really crummy work out there. And it's hard to figure out what's good, mm-hmm. but it's kind of like, you know it when you see it.
Definitely. It's kind of like, it's falling in love, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, if it's seducing you, then you're going in the right direction.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, Mason, thank you very much for taking some time out this evening to chat with us. We'll chat with me. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to do it again after the Jerusalem book and the Winogrand project, right?
Absolutely. I can I'll supply you with the links to the book and to my blog, so that your listeners can hop on over there and hopefully buy the book and hopefully listen, you know, check out the blog to see the latest Winogrand photos that I'm posting, and who knows what else might be coming up.
Awesome. Next. Thank you. And Mason, please give let the people know where they can find your blog at.
So the blog URL is resnickstreetphotos.blogspot.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mason, and best of luck with the two projects that you are working on now. And we will definitely be sharing once they're available as well. Thank you for stopping by, man.
Thank you so much, Alberto, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, excellent. Thank you, Mason.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Noisecast. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Noisecast. Also, check out our site, thenoisecast.com. Don't forget to hit the show notes so you can check out Mason's work, or whether his portfolio or his street photo project. Make sure to check out his book as well. $2 is not a bad deal for one very interesting look at Tel Aviv. So definitely hit those two up, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Peace.